This is an ABC podcast.
Kamna Māori, aloha kākou and a good morning. You're tuning into Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I'm your host Aggie DuBois, and coming up on the show, a geopolitical controversy is brewing over Taiwan's possible involvement in the upcoming Pacific Island Forum. What does the discovery of a narco sub in the Solomon Islands say when tactics are used to smuggle drugs across the Pacific? And there may be a decrease in women contesting for the upcoming elections in Bougainville, but it's not stopping the few who will be part of those navigating independence negotiations with Papua New Guinea. Those stories and more, but before we start, we'd like to acknowledge that our show comes to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. As always, Tagia Tumas, thank you for tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. Firstly, a geopolitical controversy is brewing ahead of a key Pacific meeting next month. Pacific leaders will gather in the nation of Solomon Islands in just over 4 weeks. But there's an arm wrestle underway over whether Taiwan will be able to participate. And it's still not clear exactly who will be invited to join the high-level gathering. Here's Foreign Affairs reporter Stephen Jidgets.
The Pacific Islands Forum Leaders Meeting is the region's top political gathering, and unity is typically prized. Papua New Guinea's Prime Minister James Marape says the Pacific has to stick together in uncertain times.
Togetherness is security, empowerment, and so it is in our combined interest to be together.
But that's in short supply in the lead-up to this year's gathering because there's a tense standoff over Taiwan. This year's host, Solomon Islands, has drawn close to China, and Beijing remains determined to isolate Taiwan diplomatically. Now, China's pushing Prime Minister Jeremiah Manele to block Taiwanese officials from attending the gathering. That would break a three-decade-long precedent and risk angering Taiwan's three remaining diplomatic allies in the Pacific, Palau, Tuvalu, and the Republic of Marshall Islands. Even some countries which recognise China rather than Taiwan are uneasy. Samoa's caretaker Prime Minister, Fiame Naomi Mataafa, telling The Pacific that her nation would likely boycott forum meetings if Solomon Islands stops Taiwan from attending and meeting with its Pacific partners.
Because our interpretation is that this is real interference or intervention into the sovereignty of the Pacific Forum.
Jeremiah Manele has now put forward a compromise, proposing that this year's meeting with forum partners be cancelled entirely. That would mean asking all outside players, not just China and Taiwan, but also the US and more than a dozen other countries, to stay away this year. Anna Poles from Massey University says Solomon Islands is basically kicking the geopolitical can down the road, trying to keep Beijing on side without risking a split in the forum.
Well, I think it's probably the best of a bunch of bad options here. He is very much caught in a very difficult position.
Some Pacific nations are okay with Mr. Manele's solution. One of Taiwan's closest allies, Palau, has publicly backed it. Australia says the arrangements are still being finalised and won't be drawn on whether it will back the compromise. But others are more clear. New Zealand's Prime Minister Christopher Luxon telling Radio New Zealand he'd rather not see any changes.
Our preference is that we actually have the status quo, which is what we've done over a number of years, so that the focus stays on the core work of PIF as it goes forward.
He's not alone. PNG's James Marape telling PMN News he's written to his Solomon Islands counterpart, urging him to stick with the current forum structure and let Taiwan attend.
From PNG context, we're sending advice on a letter to the Prime Minister of Solomon Islands. We should stick to the spirit of the regional architecture, isolating personal bilateral preferences.
But in an increasingly uncertain strategic environment, those personal preferences can quickly shape outcomes.
And that report from the ABC's Foreign Affairs reporter, Stephen Jidgets. Now, the discovery of a so-called narco sub in Solomon Islands is a major evolution in tactics used to smuggle drugs across the Pacific. That's beyond the current capabilities of regional law enforcement agencies to deal with, according to an expert on transnational crime. The long, narrowed narcotics submarine, also known as a low-profile vessel, was found abandoned, floating near Ramos Island by local MP Ben Mainu, while out fishing last week. Jose Suso Santos, head of the Regional Pacific Security Hub at Canterbury University, says South American cartels have used similar boats to smuggle drugs into the United States for decades, but this is the first one found in the Pacific Islands. He says they're fast, hard to detect, and will require new tactics, technology, and training to counter.
This actually shows an evolution and change in tactics, quite a large evolution and change in tactics. It definitely demonstrates that the cartels and the syndicates and triads, whichever ones this particular vessel comes from, and most likely it is from the cartels from the Americas or the South American syndicates, are more aware of the number of seizures that have been made by regional law enforcement agencies and by Australian and New Zealand law enforcement. So they are upping their game with new tried and true tactics, which they've used in against the DEA in the US for decades. But to the Pacific and to Australia and New Zealand, these are new tactics, new techniques, and new vessels. It's obviously going to be very efficient, as we don't have the capacity, capability, and experience to interdict these vehicles.
That was going to be my next question. What does it mean for law enforcement, customs, border control in the region? They're going to have to up their game, equipment, training, etc.?
All of the above. The technology being utilised at the moment by the Pacific Regional Security Architecture, by the navies, by customs, and other and law enforcement, is not up to task. And by the same token, by most of Australian agencies and New Zealand agencies, including Navy, you're dealing with low-profile vessels. You're dealing with semi-submersibles. A lot of the technology required for that is bespoke to target. Is bespoke. The experience to deal with these kind of tactics does not exist in Australia and New Zealand. I think the closest that we have would be from the Australian Border Force. So this is where Australia needs to and New Zealand need to reach out to their partners, both in the US, but also in Southeast Asia, where these type of vehicles are utilised, especially the LPVs, the low-profile vessels, to island hop and to outrun the patrol boats, and be able to further their training, to be able to choose and to upscale to the right technology to ensure that we can not just identify, but then to track and intercept, because currently there is nothing in the Pacific that can intercept these kind of vehicles at the speed at which they travel.
Apart from the question of speed, are you able to say what ways US authorities have developed to be able to combat this at all? What kind of technology, techniques they're using?
One of the only ways to identify and to be able to spot a semi-submersible is through thermal imaging. And that's through the snorkel, which lets off the fumes from the diesel engine, which is driving the semi-submersible. There is nothing above the waterline, so it's only by utilizing the thermal imaging, which shows that thermal signature. There are buoys, special kind of buoys, which are, I suppose, the closest comparison would be to the kind of buoys that are utilized to measure, for example, tsunamis when they move across the Pacific. These buoys can be put in choke points in the Pacific Islands, and when there's disturbance in the waters, which are not linked to ships which are registered, they can then red flag those occurrences, and we can then attempt to intercept. again, these kind of vessels cannot be tracked or pinpointed by satellite. So we have to adapt.
And that is Jose Sousosantos from Canterbury University's Regional Pacific Security Hub speaking to Liam Fox. Pacific Beat. Now we head to the autonomous region of Bougainville, where there has been a decrease in women contesting the upcoming election set to be held in September. It's a crucial election as voters will decide on the government who will navigate independence negotiations with Papua New Guinea. Now there are more than 400 candidates, including 31 women, who are campaigning to win one of the 46 seats in the Bougainville Parliament. Three of the seats are reserved for women, while the rest are open seats, which both men and women can contest. Our reporter, Caroline Turman, spoke with Barbara Tane, the president of the Bougainville Women's Federation, who's helping guide the women with their campaigns.
It's really interesting looking at these younger women, and they are women who are between the age of 35 and 45 who are also running.
Because Bougainville has got three reserved seats, which are especially for women, but the interest there is not as high as those contesting the regional seats. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, interesting, because I think they have said they know that reserve seats covers a larger area, and it's hard for them to be contesting in that area. And also, if they won the election, that's going to be very hard for them as well to manage, looking at the grant they're receiving. So I think the Community Government Act, having women and men in that level, I would say that we have been discussing along the way that women should not be all running for the reserve seat, because after all, we will continue to be ending with three women right in the House of Representatives. For us to be increasing the number of women in the House of Representatives, we have encouraged, and women are already seeing their space in there. And we want to have more women in the House of Representatives instead of just having three all the time.
Why is it important for women to be involved in politics in Bougainville?
Women see and they feel that the issues are not addressed by our male candidates. So the issues that women are actually, it encourages them to probably run and be there so that they can work with the issues women are faced when we are talking about gender-based violence, tertiary accusations, and other social issues like rape, incest. Also importantly, women want to see the hospital. So, you know, in terms of women and health, it's important that there is more support given to the health department, to the education department, and dealing with law and order issues to the justice system that we have, because many of the cases are just being normalized when we are talking about perpetrators being bailed out and released, and then in the end, they don't see them being put into jail. Or it just so hard that in Bougainville, women's issues are not being prioritized.
What are you hoping for the number of women candidates that you have mentioned?
I'm hoping to have an increase in women in the ABC. We want to increase it like at least 10 to 20 women to start off with. But that's our dream, to have more women's voices in the House of Representatives. We want to at least bring the number from 6 to maybe 10 and start small. Eventually, we will have to continue with increasing the number in the future.
And that was President of Bougainville's Women's Federation, Barbara Tane, speaking to reporter Caroline Turman there. Coming up shortly, it's your news wrap.
Join me, Natasha Metten, for Sisters Let's Talk. I'll be interviewing incredible guests and discussing issues that are in the hearts and minds of Pacific women.
She was just going on to 19 when she had a baby. I instantly blamed myself.
I had to take pictures of some pollution and all that, and I was attacked on board out at sea.
Tune in to Sisters Let's Talk, Thursday mornings at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
It is Aggie here, your host for Pacific Beat. Now we head into our news wrap time, and that is brought to you by our producer, Carl Evans, to get the latest on the headlines around the region. How you doing, sir?
I'm well, Aggie. I'm in a very good mood today. My senior social men's basketball team won our third game in a row last night after losing about our first 10. So we are proper rolling. That's the real news of the day.
That has to be put down to something, though. What do you think it is?
Well, Aggie, you know, I hate to say it. No, I'm kidding. No, we're just playing well. Playing well as a team.
Yeah. Sounds good. Sounds good. Well, look, obviously, we're going to head to New Zealand for this one. Some concerning news, though, where figures are showing unemployment rates for Pacific people is alarmingly high.
Yeah, more than double the national average, as a matter of fact. And the Salvation Army is actually saying things might get worse. So the quarterly labour market figures, which were released on Wednesday, showed that the unemployment rate for Pacifica people was 12.1%. That's in comparison to the national average, which is at 5.2%. It is the highest it's been since 2020. But for Pacifica people alone, it's increased 3.8 percentage points in the last 12 months.
It actually doesn't sound surprising. Because, look, I've been here for 2 years. The stats sort of sound very similar for even when we left. But any idea, though, why this is happening or actually what age groups are impacted?
Yeah, look, not surprisingly, it is mainly young people. According to a report by RNZ, Pacific labour force rates haven't actually changed that much, signalling that a lot of young people are still entering that market. But a lot of them just aren't securing jobs or training or education opportunities. Pacifica people, unfortunately, are also being hit quite hard in industries they tend to work in, such as agriculture and construction. Both are in decline or stagnation at the moment and aren't really offering new opportunities. But it's worth pointing out that the figures showed that the economy shrunk by about 2,000 jobs in the June quarter alone. Wow. And has reduced by 16,000 jobs over the last 12 months. So, I mean, they don't have themselves to blame in a lot of ways because they are on the receiving end of what's already looking to be a pretty tough jobs economy in New Zealand.
Which also is probably a good indication of actually quite a few people leaving the shores of New Zealand, coming over here to Australia to sort of try and do a little bit better.
Yeah, I fear things in Australia aren't
sort of similar
much better,
thing. Yeah. Okay, well, let's head to Fiji, where a luxurious super yacht seized by the United States is heading to the auction block.
That's right, Aggie. So if you cast your mind back, this yacht, the Amadea, was valued at more than $300 million and was seized from a Russian oligarch back in 2022 after the invasion of Ukraine, when the US Justice Department began seizing all those Russian assets of those men close to Putin. A competing claim was made for the vessel, but was dismissed by a US judge back in March, and now it's set to go under the hammer again. So if you're interested, Aggie, sealed bids are now being accepted until September 10. Initial deposits, though, are $10 million. So,
I'm there. Not. But yeah, okay, wow, interesting. Let's turn to sport now, where the draw has been announced for the 2025 Rugby League Pacific Championships.
Yes, that is right. It will be returning this year. It will be played across three countries in four consecutive weeks in October and November. Samoa will return to the tournament this year after they missed last year's champs due to that UK tour. So they'll face off with the 2024 runner-up Tonga as part of an explosive opening doubleheader in Australia on October 26. New Zealand will round out the men's draw as the third team. Meanwhile, Fiji, PNG and the Cook Islands will compete for the Pacific Bowl. The final will again be played in Western Sydney. Who can forget those scenes last year at Parramatta Park with that sea of red with the Tongan fans as they almost beat Australia. Australia this time, however, they actually won't be competing in the competition. This time it's going to be them heading over to the UK to face England in what's going to be a return of the Ashes series. The Jillaroos, though, the Australian women's team, they will be competing in the women and they'll be competing alongside New Zealand, Fetu, Samoa, Cook Islands, Moana, the PNG Orchids and Tonga. Tonga will round out the women's draw.
Sounds exciting, and I know we will be across all of that. So, yeah, look forward to that. Finally, though, we go to Guam. They've made their debut at the FIBA Basketball Asian Cup. How did this go?
That's right, which is actually in Saudi Arabia. I watched a little bit of it last night. But, no, I just wanted to give Guam a shout-out because it's their first time at this tournament. And, you know, it's one of the biggest tournaments in the world, certainly the biggest in the Asian part of the world. But you're talking about Guam, which is a population of, what, 100, 150,000 people?
Yeah.
Who knows? Taking on some absolute basketball powerhouses, you know, Japan and India and China and countries of, you know, a billion people and up. Not to mention Australia and New Zealand, who are also very good as well. So, no, it's great to see them representing on that stage. They had their first game yesterday to Iran. They lost 77-52. And still have a couple of days break now. They'll next take on Syria and then Japan. So, yeah, we hope they do well. Australia and New Zealand, they're obviously two powerhouses. They won their first two games. They regularly compete at the Olympics, and this tournament is an Olympic qualifier. So, you know, for Guam to make it this far,
it's
quite incredible.
Yeah, any time to see any of our Pacific nations make it on the world stage like that. Because isn't it Guam's national sport, basketball, or is it baseball? Somewhere around there.
Definitely say it's basketball in Guam. Baseball's Palau. They love baseball in Palau, huge basketball fan base in Guam. And obviously, you know, you got a lot of former military or current military people who I'm sure would play basketball, become naturalized and come to represent them.
Absolutely.
But not only that, they've got a lot of players who will grow up there. And because they're American citizens, they'll go over and play U.S. college and obviously, you know, develop their games and then come back and represent their small island.
Yeah. Well done, Guam. Okay, look, thanks, Carl, for our news wrap.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. Now, this week, the Cook Islands is celebrating 60 years of self-governance and free association with New Zealand. This comes as tensions continue to simmer between the two nations, with a big sticking point being the lack of consultation over the Cook Islands' growing relationship with China. Te Anautiono is a New Zealand Member of Parliament with the Greens Party. He's in Rarotonga and he says celebrations have been vibrant, but the New Zealand Prime Minister's no-show has gone unnoticed.
It's been a magical time here back home in the Cook Islands. We've had a week of the Mai Vanui cultural performances, and people have come out from the Pai and we're from all around in the outer islands as well. So it's been really wonderful to be with everybody, to share in the cultural performances and to see relatives as well. I've got relatives that live here. My oldest child lives here as well. So to reconnect with family and to celebrate 60 years of self-governance is incredibly significant for our people.
Now, Te Anau, New Zealand Prime Minister Christopher Luxon was criticised for attending a lunch marking PNG's 50th independence anniversary rather than coming to the Cook Islands for this milestone event. And I think he probably is the first New Zealand Prime Minister to not attend an event of this significance. Now, what message do you think that sends?
I don't think that sends a very good signal, the fact that the Prime Minister is in the Pacific but actually over in Papua New Guinea and not coming here to the 60th. I think that was noted by people. But what I would say is Dame Cindy Kiro delivered her speech very well. It was very well received, a very strong speech from Dame Cindy Kiro and a very dignified speech as well, which talked about the connections that we have as Cook Island Māori with Māori and Aotearoa Māori in New Zealand as well. So we're talking about this first 60 years of self-governance as well, but these connections are centuries old. So it's important to acknowledge those connections as well. And also a number of people talked about the enormous contribution that Cook Islanders make to New Zealand, and I think that needs to be acknowledged particularly by people in New Zealand. I think of places like Tokoroa, where Cook Islanders played a significant part in the industry there as well, and also during World War One, where we played a significant contribution serving alongside the Anzacs as well. These parts of history are very well known with our people in the Cook Islands and in the Cook Islands diaspora, but not so much in New Zealand. So not having the Prime Minister of New Zealand here, I think sent the wrong signal. But hey, we're here to celebrate 60 years and celebrate being with our people.
Mm. Now, there's been growing friction between the two nations in recent months, especially including over the Cook Islands' closeness with China. Lots has been spoken about that, the suggestion of a Cook Islands passport and New Zealand pausing development funding. How would you describe the relationship with New Zealand at the moment?
Well, it's a bit bumpy, and I say that somebody that sits over in Aotearoa as a member of parliament and the New Zealand parliament as well. I think we need to get to a place where we think about what's best for the community, particularly for people here in the Cook Islands and for those of us in the diaspora as well. I know that's what everybody wants. The speeches that I heard today, at the heart of it, is that's what everybody wants, what's best for the people and to chart a pathway forward. That is what both governments should be doing, sitting down and finding the best pathway forward.
Well, a path forward with the Cook Islands. Now, they've decided to strengthen ties with Beijing. Now, how do you feel about this? Do you think that they are benefiting the Cook Islands?
Part of the deal, as I understand it, is around deep sea mining. I am in the Greens. The environment is really incredibly important for us. So regardless of who does it, China, America, or someone's next door neighbour, we will always be opposed to deep sea mining. On the ground here, I did spend some time with the Te Pukaria Society and the Kōrero Te Oro as well. We actually went out with the Kōrero Te Oro, with Dr. Tēnā Rongo, who showed us a project that they were doing, getting rid of taramea as well, who have been an invasive species as well. And he also expressed many concerns about deep sea mining, particularly the deep sea mining aspects with this China deal as well. So that part of it we cannot support. But there are other issues around self-determination, around the ability for people to make their own choices, the ability for people here in the home islands to make their own decisions and to chart their pathway forward, and the importance for New Zealand to understand that. There is a lot of concern about the growing influence of China in the region, and some Pacific Island nations may not have handled that as well as they could have. People fear losing economic independence as well. But on the other hand, when we talk about geopolitical tension as well, it's important to note that the Americans have packed up and gone home, essentially. USAID has been disbanded. There's no more US development funding out here as well. So it is. So people in the islands, across all the different islands, are looking for people to work with, looking for people to build those partnerships, to move themselves forward. I would like that the most environmentally sustainable way that we can do that, because that's our kaupapa as part of the Green Party, focusing on ocean conservation and reminding people, as they do right across the Pacific, that actually the Pacific is on the front lines of climate change. When you go and talk to people about the existential threat facing the Pacific, they don't say China, they say climate change. So people need to come to the party and to support Pacific Island nations to walk their path of self-determination, but walk it in a way that it means that we take climate action seriously, and so that it matters most here in the Pacific.
And that is New Zealand Greens Party MP Te Anauti Ono speaking to the Pacific's co-host, Johnson Raera.
Want to immerse yourself in sport and stories of athletes from across the Pacific? Well, join me, Sam Wykes, alongside some of the most talented journalists and sports commentators from across the region for Fresh Off the Field. Each week, we'll bring you interviews with Pacific athletes leaving their mark on the international stage and those aspiring to do the same. From cricket to netball, athletics to rugby, and everything in between. Fresh Off the Field, Thursday afternoon at 4 p.m. PNG time on Radio Australia.
Avinaka, thank you for joining me, Aggie the Bull, on Pacific Beat. Well, next month will mark exactly 80 years since the end of the Second World War, and many battles that shaped the outcome took place in the Pacific. One of those was the Battle of Guadalcanal, a bloody five-month campaign between Japanese and Allied forces, which commenced on this very day when US troops landed in the Solomon Islands in 1943. Today, the US Embassy in Honiara will host an 83rd commemoration of the battle, and among those attending is World War II researcher and tour guide in the Solomon Islands, Michael Benn, who spoke to Kyle Evans earlier about the vital role islanders played in the Allied victory.
For us islanders, especially for those of us who took part in the battle as scouts and carriers for the Americans or Marines, the whole battle itself has a very important significance of determining the actual role that the islanders had played. But this battle was supposed not to be fought on this soil, but somehow it reached Guadalcanal that we have to, you know, go on defending our island in the Pacific. So I think it brought a big history for us too in the Pacific, mainly on Guadalcanal.
Yeah, well, let's talk about the contributions of the islanders, because I know that the US managed to overcome the Japanese forces in the battle, but not without the help of Solomon Islanders. Can you explain what role they played?
Well, the actual role that the islanders actually played on the side of the Americans or the U.S. and allied forces is that they do have the courage to lead the platoons and the patrols to the front lines where the enemies are. So without the islanders knowing the exact sites in the jungles, we see that the Americans couldn't know exactly where to find these enemies, where they camped in the jungle. So with the courage that the islanders had, they did manage to overcome the enemy.
And I imagine it would have been very dangerous for them because, you know, the Japanese probably would have considered the Solomon Islanders an enemy because they were helping the Americans. Is that right?
Yes, exactly. In some occasions, some of our scouts, because the Japanese were hiding on top of the trees, the coconut trees or any other trees, but as soon as they saw the islanders leaving in the front, some of them were injured. They shot them, and with the help of the Americans, they were healed and to continue their task. But they are totally seen as enemies too, as well as Americans.
Now, there'll obviously be a big commemoration event taking place in Honiara today, which I know that you'll be attending. And you'll actually be telling stories about the islanders' contributions. What kind of things do you have planned?
The actual role of these scouts and the courage that they played is important for us islanders because I have to put together some of the contributions, the type of contributions and the characters that the islanders do have by leading these Americans to the front lines, in the battle lines. And I know that most of our scouts, because I did interview some of them when they were still alive, I was so lucky to get some of the stories, and there is a small book that we published here recording the actions or the courage of the scouts who were with the Americans at that time.
Yeah, well, I remember when I was in Honiara, actually, and I think I remember reading about a local Solomon Islander who actually won a war medal.
Yes, yes. Sergeant Jacob Uza, who was tortured by the Japanese beyond the captured airfield at Lunga.
Now, I know that you're a tour guide as well, and you're a researcher. How much interest does this battle generate after all these years?
So far at the moment now, losing a lot of histories, people are almost forgetting about what the history of the battle here. But with the help that we are trying to produce as a researcher, trying to recapture the ideas from the scouts themselves, it helped us a lot to put them in a book, and we are now working on a book to be distributed to the schools for the present generations.
Yeah, it's really important that those details aren't lost to history. And just finally, when you think of the Solomon Islands, there's still so much ordnance from World War II that's scattered around the place. There's relics of old tanks and planes in the jungle. What do you think the legacy of World War II is in the Solomon Islands?
The remains of all these war relics really bring back the memory of the Second World War to our present generations. And most of them do not know the actual history, but with seeing all these relics around, it creates a legacy that they know that something happened here, say, about 82, 83 years ago.
And that is World War II researcher and tour guide in the Solomon Islands, Michael Benn. Now, new research is exploring the impacts climate change has had on cultural heritage in the South Pacific. The researcher, Zoe Bridge, a PhD candidate at the University of the Sunshine Coast, is also exploring if there are alternative heritage management practices for climate change from a Pacific Islander perspective. A PhD candidate at the University of Sunshine Coast told Lucy Cooper it's hoped the research will give agency to Pacific Islanders and recognise the significance of environmental knowledge in the region.
The aim of the PhD was to recognise the significance of Pacific Islander cultural heritage that's often undervalued within the global community, but also to recognise that they have this unique ability to adapt to climate change that the rest of the global south doesn't, and they have unique perspectives.
With the PhD, how have you kind of gone about achieving that?
So to achieve what I've done, I've actually spent time in Fiji and collecting data by talking to different participants to understand their perspective and to highlight their perspective, because there's often a reliance on looking at the past and looking at archival records and then, you know, looking at all of our peer-reviewed journals, but that's not the way things are done in the Pacific. A lot of histories and a lot of knowledge is orally passed on. And my PhD isn't about documenting the oral knowledge, it's more about highlighting the significance of understanding how particular cultures go about preserving their culture and how they would like the rest of the Western world to see it.
We're here at the JCU campus in Townsville for the National History Conference. This has got a lot of different people from all across Australia, and really there's no one topic, it's history is what's brought everyone together. What do you kind of like to highlight in terms of Pacific history?
I often see that Pacific history is overlooked. We've got thousands of years of history that are very significant to the migration of humans. And a lot of the time people look at the Pacific and see, you know, they see culture through, you know, like dances and songs, but they have a wealth of knowledge to offer us. They're people that have lived in these islands for millennia, and they are very significant, and I've been very grateful that I've been able to come to this conference and offer a different perspective of Pacific Islander history that is often overlooked.
And what is that different perspective?
To me, the different perspective is, it's more than just obviously song and dance. It's understanding that there is a very significant culture that is connected to the land and the sea, that has ongoing connections throughout the entirety of the South Pacific. They're a very diverse group of peoples. They also have a lot of knowledge that we often overlook that is very significant that we could apply in, you know, modern day sciences, into climate change studies, into documenting oral histories, documenting histories as a whole. They offer alternative perspectives that are very critical within the history space.
What are you finding along the way in terms of, you know, how climate change is affecting how we pass on knowledge about the environment?
So climate change is affecting the transmission of environmental knowledge at an accelerated rate, because this knowledge that they've had for millennia all of a sudden doesn't quite line up. So, for example, particular trees such as your mango trees or your breadfruit trees are flowering a lot earlier. So if they were originally flowering in that November-December period, they're now flowering anywhere earlier, starting between August, September and October. So it just demonstrates that there's this shift. And it's really important that we start documenting what knowledge there is so that the global community can understand, but also understanding that it's shifting for them. So their knowledge is now changing. So that environmental knowledge that they used to have has now shifted into a different space. So moving forward, it's understanding that the climate's changed, but we can apply that environmental knowledge that they do currently have. Even though it's not what it originally was, it is shifting slightly, but it doesn't mean that it's changed completely and therefore it's no longer significant. It just means it's in it's in this transition period potentially.
When you're passing on information that is, you know, different from what is currently happening, how is that impacting people's lives?
Well, it's impacting their lives, because examples that have been given to me is you go into the plantation in the morning and you read the indicators in Nature to know when you need to plant a particular fruit or a particular vegetable, and that knowledge is now shifting because the nature isn't representing what it used to. So those indicators of, oh, we plant at this particular time, they're not showing up anymore. So that impacts, you know, food production. It also impacts, other impacts are like sea level rise. Sea level rise is causing encroachment on those lower lying crops. So that's also impacting the knowledge of where they plant their particular plantation. So that might be the original site of the plantation, but now they need to move it somewhere else. And then they don't know about that environment around that plantation because they have no knowledge.
And that's Zoe Bridge, PhD candidate at the University of the Sunshine Coast. Out to the world of sport now. After signing a memorandum of understanding with China back in May, the Fiji Rugby Union have signed a second MOU, this time with Qatar. The three-year deal involves what's described as a comprehensive partnership covering player exchanges, coaching programs, joint training camps, and commercial opportunities for both countries. The latest member to join Fiji's rugby's board is Leilani Burns. She will be at the heart of driving the commercial aspect of the agreement in her new role now as Director of Rugby. The former Fijiana captain has had a long-standing ambition to be involved in rugby governance in Fiji, and when the opportunity came her way to join the board, she says she was well prepared.
I guess in terms of my appointment, it's been a bit of a vested interest by both parties. I've always been of the opinion that I would like to step up into the board and to be able to give back to the sport I love. So I had actually been engaged in a couple of different programs, the World Rugby Capgemini Women in Leadership and Governance. So I've been doing that for the past 2 years, and that program really is to be able to provide women that are involved in rugby the opportunity and the skills and the experience to be ready to step into those board positions. And there was also another program that I've been doing, the Oceania Rugby Rice Program, which is a similar program to ensure that women are well equipped and ready to step up into board roles, which I finished earlier this year. So that's what I've been planning to do for a while. And I know that there was a position that was available on the board, and there was discussions with me to see if I was interested, and that my name was put forward and nominated by Nandi Rugby Union, and then second also through by the Asawa Rugby Union as well.
There's been, I think it's fair to say, a sea change in terms of the way rugby is being run in Fiji now as compared to what it was, say, a couple of years ago. So it would seem to me that you're joining the board at the right time, because I assume you have your objectives and your chances of succeeding with those objectives are perhaps higher than they would have been in the past.
From what I can see, we are all working towards the same goal, and that is really to be able to give it back to the sport that we love and to be able to take this sport and strategically move it towards the future. So in terms of what I'm wanting to achieve over the next 12 months, for instance, you know, there's a lot of support. We're very much working together to be able to bring forth positive change. So indeed, a timely appointment for me.
As far as the future development of women's rugby, how would you like to see things progress?
Women's rugby is vital, and my fellow director, Mrs. Kathy Wong, leads the women's program, and she does it superbly. But my role really covers a wider scope. So together we make sure that every player, whether it's a girl or a boy, does have an equal chance to be able to shine. But for me as the director of rugby, I oversee all pathways. So what that means is making sure that Fijian rugby for men and the women from village level right through to the national team has got those clear structures in place, including strong coaching and safe competitions, so that we can support both our men and our women in terms of player development every single step of the way.
Now, I understand that confirmation of Tier 1 status for Fiji rugby is imminent, and I'm sure you will be aware that I think the media over there in Fiji have already decided it's been granted, but I understand it's not quite official yet, but we're not far away. When it comes, what is the significance of Tier 1 status for women's rugby? Will they benefit from it as much as the men?
I think the whole union and the game will benefit, Richard, you know, because when you're looking at Tier 1 status, what does that bring? It brings about tougher test matches. It brings about opportunities for both the men and the women to be able to play. It also brings about bigger audiences. And what does that mean? It also looks at more revenue. So in terms of the Tier 1 status in my role, it's really about working together with the board to make sure that we invest that revenue back into coaching, medical cover, and grassroots. So the whole system, not just the men's game, but the women's game also lifts. And this is also included right through from the grassroots level right up to our national teams.
How do you think it will impact on the spread of international players who can represent Fiji? At the moment, of course, significant numbers, particularly in the men's team, tend to be based overseas. Do you see that situation changing?
Well, you know, when you're actually looking at the development within the country itself, you know, we are seeing seeing a massive growth of our players coming through from a grassroots system. And when you have a look, for instance, at our Fijian drill side coming through from grassroots provincial competitions like the Skipper Cup or the Marama Championships, over 70% of our players that represent the country in the Fijian drill are from that grassroots level. And then this then equates into stepping up into the national team. And you can see that there's definitely been a growth at the number of locally based players that are out there representing the country as well. So I think over time, look, we'll just need to keep on tabs and see how everyone is tracking right across the board to be able to make the decision on who deserves the opportunity to be able to don that white jersey and represent the country with pride.
And tell me, with the Women's World Cup less than 3 weeks away now, what are you expecting from Fijiana? They're in a pretty tough group with Canada currently rated number two in the world, Scotland and Wales both in the top 10.
Well, you know, I know that the team has been working really hard, and watching the women's game, it is definitely going from strength to strength. But for me, really, the bigger picture is about making sure that the national team, whether it's the men's or the women's team, sends a powerful message to our young players across the islands that the world stage is not just a dream, it's a real and achievable goal. And for me, it's really about our people and our young people being able to look at these national players, like our women heading out and representing the country in the Rugby World Cup, because that really does have a deep impact on our communities. And when our people across Fiji sees these amazing athletes, both our men and women, competing out there with pride on the international stage, what it does is it sparks belief, not just in rugby, but what's possible in life. And it really shows that the talent from our villages can really shine globally with the right support and the right structures, so that anyone really has the opportunity to be able to rise.
And that's Leilani Burns, former captain of Fijiana, and now a member of the board and director of rugby for the Fiji Rugby Union, and she was talking to Richard Hewitt.
Join Jacob McQuire and Michael Chow for Nisha Daily every weekday morning on ABC Radio Australia.
Aggie, how are you going?
Yeah, malolele, it's good to catch up with you guys. Shouldn't say guys, I should say men, eh?
Yeah, we're big boys.
You know what I mean?
We're adults.
I haven't been described as a man for some time now. All right, I am a guy.
Okay. I'm always good to know.
We're chilling.
Nisha Daily, weekday mornings from 7 o'clock PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Disasters are inevitable, but losing your life or home isn't. Learn what to do before, during, and after disaster in a program aimed at helping you keep safe. Pacific Prepared is all things disaster preparedness for the Pacific, with a team of reporters on the ground, having conversations, and bringing you the stories that could help you, your family, and community prepare for natural disasters. Pacific Prepared, Fridays from 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Recapping our top story, an arm wrestle is underway over whether Taiwan will be able to participate at the Pacific Island Forum, with Samoa's caretaker PM saying they could boycott the meeting if Solomon Islands stops Taiwan from attending.
Because our interpretation is that this is real interference or intervention into the sovereignty of the Pacific Forum.
And that's Samoa's Prime Minister Fiamme Naomi Mataa for speaking there. The team will be back tomorrow at 6 a.m. PNG time. You can hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. at PNG time. Stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia, though, because your news is next. And coming up after that, it is Nisha Daily. So until then, o tō awhātou. Thank you for tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.
What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics, and how does it affect us? PolyTalk is back to unpack the big questions, like why is it hard to get medicine you need in the Pacific?
It came to a point where he was admitted where he got blood poisoning. He needed antibiotics for that, and that was not available.
Join me, Scott Whitehair, on PolyTalk.
Search up PolyTalk in your favourite podcast app to listen.